Hello there. My name is Greg, and I'm a reader with the Talking Information Center. For the next hour, I'll be reading you the news headlines from the AP Network Newswire for Tuesday, February 17th, 2026. It's a gray day in Massachusetts. If you're in this listening area, might get a little snow over the next day or two, but then it's supposed to warm up next week, which will be good for those of us who have ice dams. That's a little thing. It's a big thing to contend with, for sure. So let's get into the stories. There's a lot going on in the world. The first story we will take a look at has to do with Reverend Jesse Jackson. The headline reads, "The Reverend Jesse Jackson, who led the civil rights movement for decades after King, has died at 84. Story comes from Chicago. The Reverend Jesse L. Jackson, a protege of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and a two-time presidential candidate who led the civil rights movement for decades after the revered leader's assassination, died on Tuesday at age 84. As a young organizer in Chicago, Jackson was called to meet with King at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, shortly before King was killed, and he publicly positioned himself thereafter as King's successor. Jackson led a lifetime of crusades in the United States and abroad, advocating for the poor and underrepresented on issues from voting rights and job opportunities to education and health care. He scored diplomatic victories with world leaders, and through his Rainbow Push Coalition, he channeled cries for black pride and self-determination into corporate boardrooms, pressuring executives to make America a more open and equitable society. And when he declared, 'I am somebody,' in a poem he often repeated, he sought to reach people of all colors. 'I may be poor, but I am somebody. I may be young, but I am somebody. I may be on welfare, but I am somebody,' Jackson intoned. It was a message he took literally and personally, having risen from obscurity in the segregated South to become America's best-known civil rights activist since King. Sunita Jackson confirmed that her father died at home in Chicago, surrounded by his family. 'Our father was a servant leader, not only to our family, but to the oppressed, the voiceless, and the overlooked around the world,' the Jackson family said in a statement posted online. 'We shared him with the world, and in return, the world became a part of our extended family.' Fellow civil rights activist, the Reverend Al Sharpton, said his mentor was, quote, 'not simply a civil rights leader, he was a movement unto himself. He taught me that protest must have purpose, that faith must have feet, and that justice is not seasonal. It is daily work.' Sharpton added that Jackson taught, quote, 'trying is as important as triumph, that you do not wait for the dream to come true, you work to make it real.' Despite profound health challenges in his final years, including a rare neurological disorder that affected his ability to move and speak, Jackson continued protesting against racial injustice into the era of Black Lives Matter. In 2024, he appeared at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago and at a city council meeting to show support for a resolution backing a ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war. 'Even if we win,' he told marchers in Minneapolis, before the officer whose knee kept George Floyd from breathing was convicted of murder, 'it is a relief, not a victory. They are still killing our people. Stop the violence. Save the children. Keep hope alive.' Jackson's voice, infused with the stirring cadences and powerful insistence of the Black church, demanded attention. On the campaign trail and elsewhere, he used rhyming and slogans such as 'hope, not dope,' and 'if my mind can conceive it and my heart can believe it, then I can achieve it,' to deliver his messages. Jackson had his share of critics, both within and outside the Black community. Some considered him a grandstander, too eager to seek out the spotlight. Looking back on his life and legacy, Jackson told the Associated Press in 2011 that he felt blessed to be able to continue the service of other leaders before him and to lay a foundation for those to come. 'A part of our life's work was to tear down walls and build bridges, and in half a century of work, we've basically torn down the walls, Jackson said. Sometimes when you tear down walls, you're scarred by falling debris, but your mission is to open up holes so others behind you can run through. In his final months, as he received 24-hour care, he lost his ability to speak, communicating with family and visitors by holding their hands and squeezing. I get very emotional knowing that these speeches belong to the ages now, his son Jesse Jackson Jr. told the AP in October. Jesse Lewis Jackson was born on October 8, 1941, in Greenville, South Carolina, the son of a high school student, Helen Burns, and Noah Lewis Robinson, a married man who lived next door. Jackson was later adopted by Charles Henry Jackson, who married his mother. Jackson was a star quarterback on the football team at Sterling High School in Greenville and accepted a football scholarship from the University of Illinois. But after he reportedly was told black people couldn't play quarterback, he transferred to North Carolina A&T in Greensboro, where he became the first string quarterback, an honor student in sociology and economics, and the student body president. Arriving on the historically black campus in 1960, just months after students there launched sit-ins at a whites-only diner, Jackson immersed himself in the blossoming civil rights movement. By 1965, he joined the Voting Rights March King led from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama. King dispatched him to Chicago to launch Operation Breadbasket, a Southern Christian Leadership Conference effort to pressure companies to hire black workers. Jackson called his time with King a phenomenal 4 years of work. Jackson was with King on April 4, 1968, when the civil rights leader was slain. Jackson's account of the assassination was that King died in his arms. With his flair for the dramatic, Jackson wore a turtleneck he said was soaked with King's blood for 2 days, including at a King memorial service held by the Chicago City Council, where he said, "I come here with a heavy heart because on my chest is the stain of blood from Dr. King's head." However, several King aides, including speechwriter Alfred Duckett, questioned whether Jackson could have gotten King's blood on his clothing. There are no images of Jackson in pictures taken shortly after the assassination. In 1971, Jackson broke with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to form Operation Push, originally named People United to Save Humanity. The organization, based on Chicago's South Side, declared a sweeping mission from diversifying workforces to registering voters in communities of color nationwide. Using lawsuits and threats of boycotts, Jackson pressured top corporations to spend millions and publicly commit to diversifying their workforces. The constant campaigns often left his wife, Jacqueline Lavinia Brown, the college sweetheart he married in 1963, taking the lead in raising their 5 children, Santita Jackson, Yusef DuBois Jackson, Jacqueline Lavinia Jackson Jr., and 2 future members of Congress, U.S. Representative Jonathan Luther Jackson and Jesse L. Jackson Jr., who resigned in 2012 but is seeking re-election in the 2026 midterms. The elder Jackson, who was ordained as a Baptist minister in 1968 and earned his Master of Divinity in 2000, also acknowledged fathering a child, Ashley Jackson, with one of his employees at Rainbow Push, Karen L. Stanford. He said he understood what it means to be born out of wedlock and supported her emotionally and financially. Despite once telling a black audience he would not run for president because white people are incapable of appreciating me, Jackson ran twice and did better than any black politician had before President Barack Obama, winning 13 primaries and caucuses for the Democratic nomination in 1988, 4 years after his first failed attempt. His successors led left supporters chanting another Jackson slogan, "Keep hope alive." "I was able to run for the presidency twice and redefined what was possible. It raised the lid for women and other people of color," he told the AP. "Part of my job was to sow seeds of the possibilities." U.S. Representative John Lewis said during a 1988 C-SPAN interview that Jackson's 2 runs for the Democratic nomination opened some doors that some minority person will be able to walk through and become president. Jackson also pushed for cultural change, joining calls by the NAACP members and other movement leaders in the late 1980s to identify black people in the United States as African Americans. To be called African Americans has a cultural integrity. It puts us in our proper historical context, Jackson said at the time. Every ethnic group in this country has a reference to some base, some historical cultural base. African Americans have hit that level of cultural maturity. Jackson's words sometimes got him in trouble. In 1984, he apologized for what he thought were private comments to a reporter calling New York City Hymetown a derogatory reference to its large Jewish population. And in 2008, he made headlines when he complained that Obama was talking down to black people in comments captured by a microphone he didn't know was on during a break in a television taping. Still, when Jackson joined the jubilant crowd in Chicago's Grant Park to greet Obama that election night, he had tears streaming down his face. I wish for a moment that Dr. King or slain civil rights leader Medgar Evers could have just been there for 30 seconds to see the fruits of their labor, he told the AP years later. I became overwhelmed. It was the joy and the journey. Jackson also had influence abroad, meeting world leaders and scoring diplomatic victories, including the release of Navy Lieutenant Robert Goodman from Syria in 1984, as well as the 1990 release of more than 700 foreign women and children held after Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. In 1999, he won the freedom of three Americans imprisoned by Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. In 2000, President Bill Clinton awarded Jackson the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the country's highest civilian honor. Citizens have the right to do something or do nothing, Jackson said before heading to Syria. We chose to do something. In 2021, Jackson joined the parents of Ahmaud Arbery inside the Georgia courtroom, where three white men were convicted of killing the young black jogger. In 2022, he hand-delivered a letter to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago, calling for federal charges against former Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke. Excuse me. In the 2014 killing of black teenager Laquan McDonald. Jackson, who stepped down as president of Rainbow Push in July 2023, disclosed in 2017 that he had sought treatment for Parkinson's, but he continued to make public appearances even as the disease made it more difficult for listeners to understand him. Earlier this year, doctors confirmed a diagnosis of progressive supranuclear palsy, a life-threatening neurological disorder. He was admitted to a hospital in November for nearly 2 weeks. During the coronavirus pandemic, he and his wife survived being hospitalized with COVID-19. Jackson was vaccinated early, urging black people in particular to get protected, given their higher risks for bad outcomes. It's America's unfinished business. We're free but not equal, Jackson told the AP. There's a reality check that has been brought by the coronavirus that exposes the weakness and the opportunity. So very interesting story about a great figure in American civil rights, Jesse Jackson, passing away in Chicago yesterday at the age of 84. We'll take a look. There's a lot to cover today. I will take a look at this story, which is a story that you may have heard of. It comes from Rhode Island yesterday afternoon. The headline reads, "Shooting at a Rhode Island youth hockey game leaves three dead, including the shooter, and three more wounded." Story comes from Pawtucket, Rhode Island. A shooting during a Rhode Island youth hockey game left three people dead, including the shooter, and three more hospitalized Monday night in critical condition, authorities said. Pawtucket Police Chief Tina Gonzalez told reporters that someone helped bring a swift end to the violent scene Monday afternoon by intervening and trying to subdue the shooter, who was at an arena to watch a family member's hockey game. The shooter died from an apparent self-inflicted gun wound, she said, noting that authorities were still investigating. It appears that this was a targeted event, that it may be a family dispute, she said. Gonsalves identified the shooter as Robert Dorgan, who, she said, also went by the name Roberta Esposito and was born in 1969. The police chief did not provide further details about the shooter or the victims, except for saying it appeared that both victims who died were adults. She said investigators were trying to piece together what happened and have spoken with scores of witnesses who were there inside the Dennis M. Lynch Arena in Pawtucket, a few miles outside Providence. They were also reviewing video taken from the hockey game. Unverified footage circulating on social media shows players diving for cover and fans fleeing their seats after popping sounds are heard. Outside the arena, tearful families and high school hockey players still in uniform were seen hugging before they boarded a bus to leave the area. Monday's shooting came nearly 2 months after Rhode Island was rocked by a gun violence tragedy at Brown University, where a gunman killed 2 students and wounded 9 others. That shooter went on to also fatally shoot a Massachusetts Institute of Technology professor. Authorities later found Claudio Neves Valente, 48 years old, dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound at a New Hampshire storage facility. The fortunate thing is that the 2 incidents are not related, but it is very tragic, Pawtucket Mayor Don Grebian said. These are high school kids. They were doing an event. They were playing with their families, watching. A fun time, and it turned into this. Pawtucket is nestled just north of Providence and right under the Massachusetts state border. A city of just under 80,000, Pawtucket has held up recently, has Pawtucket had up until recently been known as the home to Hasbro's headquarters. So a little update on really a tragic story to come out of Pawtucket yesterday afternoon. I'll take a look at a story that has drawn the attention of many people for now more than 2 weeks. The headline reads, Nancy Guthrie kidnapping investigators work with Walmart after identifying the suspect's backpack. Investigators working on the disappearance of today's show host Savannah Guthrie's mother are consulting with Walmart management to develop leads because a backpack the suspect was wearing is sold exclusively at the stores, the Pima County, Arizona sheriff said on Monday. Nancy Guthrie, 84 years old, was last seen at her Arizona home on January 31st and was reported missing the following day. Authorities say her blood was found on the front porch. Purported ransom notes were sent to news outlets, but 2 deadlines for paying have passed. The Federal Bureau of Investigation released surveillance videos of a masked person wearing a handgun holster outside Guthrie's front door in Tucson the night she vanished. A porch camera recorded video of a person with a backpack who was wearing a ski mask, long pants, a jacket, and gloves. Pima County Sheriff Chris Nano said in a text message to the Associated Press on Monday that the 25-liter Ozark Trail Hiker Pack backpack was the only clothing item that has been definitively identified. This backpack is exclusive to Walmart, and we are working with Walmart management to develop further leads. The suspect's clothing may have been purchased from Walmart, but is not exclusively available at Walmart, the Pima County Sheriff's Department said in a statement on Monday. This remains a possibility only. Investigators on Sunday announced that a glove discovered near the Guthrie home has been sent for DNA testing. The FBI said that it received preliminary results Saturday and was awaiting official confirmation. The development comes as law enforcement gathers more potential evidence and as the search for Guthrie's mother heads into its 3rd week. Authorities previously said they had not identified a suspect. The FBI said the suspect in the surveillance footage is a man about 5 feet 9 inches tall with a medium build. Nano said on Monday that members of Guthrie's family, including siblings and spouses, are not suspects. The family has been nothing but cooperative and gracious, and we are victims in this case, Nanos said in a statement. Authorities have expressed concern about Nancy Guthrie's health because she needs vital daily medicine. She is said to have a pacemaker and have dealt with high blood pressure and heart issues, according to the sheriff's dispatcher audio on broadcastify.com. So what a strange investigation. Kind of a an update on not much. Apparently the backpack that the person on the video was wearing is an exclusive Walmart product, and that might give the investigators some type of a lead, but there's a lot of Walmart customers out in Arizona, I'm guessing. The next headline reads, a Delaware man married in the 70s to former First Lady Jill Biden is set to plea in his wife's death. Story comes from Wilmington, Delaware. The long-ago first husband of former First Lady Jill Biden is set to appear in court on Tuesday in Delaware on charges he killed his current wife. William Stevenson, 77, is expected to enter a plea in the first-degree murder case. He was married to Jill Biden from 1970 to 1975. A state grand jury this month charged Stevenson with killing Linda Stevenson, 64 years old, who was found unresponsive at their home December 28th. He has remained in custody since the February 3rd charges, unable to post the $500,000 bail. Court records made public so far do not list a defense lawyer for him. William Stevenson founded the Stone Balloon, a popular music venue in Newark, Delaware, in the early 1970s. Linda Stevenson ran a bookkeeping business and was described in her obituary as a family-oriented mother and grandmother and a Philadelphia Eagles fan. The obituary does not mention her husband. One hug from her and all your worries would disappear, her daughter Christine May wrote in a Facebook post. The pain of losing her is paralyzing, and the emptiness in my heart is an abyss. Joe Biden married U.S. Senator Joe Biden in 1977. He served as U.S. president from January 2021 to January 2025. Jill Biden's spokesperson has said she has no comment on the Stevenson case. Kind of a strange story that the former husband of Jill Biden up for murdering his second wife. Let's see, it's Fat Tuesday. Tomorrow is Ash Wednesday. And the headline of this story is New Orleans celebrates the Mardi Gras, the indulgent conclusion of carnival season. As people head back to work Tuesday after the long holiday weekend, beads will be flying, crawfish boiling, and parades rolling in New Orleans as the city celebrates Mardi Gras. Mardi Gras, also known as Fat Tuesday, marks the climax and end of the weeks-long carnival season and a final chance for indulgence, feasting, and revelry before the Christian Lent period of sacrifice and reflection. The joyous goodbye to carnival always falls the day before Ash Wednesday. Among the final parades in Louisiana's most populous city, which is world famous for its Mardi Gras bash, is one hosted by the Zulu Social Aid and Pleasure Club. Marchers and float riders in the Zulu parade wear African-inspired garb and toss throws, trinkets that include plastic beads, candy, stuffed animals, cups, and toys. This parade's signature throw is a hand-decorated coconuts, coveted items that many revelers hope for. Later in the day, Rex, the King of Carnival Parade, will roll along St. Charles Avenue, lined by parade goers and stately oak trees covered in Spanish moss and beads. Carnival events are popular for their spectacular and enormous floats and also the intricately crafted outfits worn, such as black masking Indians, whose beaded and bejeweled costumes are topped with feathered headdresses, or parade goers walking the French Quarter in homemade costumes that capture the unique spirit of the Big Easy. The good times were rolled not just in New Orleans, but all across the state, from exclusive balls to the Cajun French tradition of the Courier de Mardi Gras or Fat Tuesday Run, a rural event in central Louisiana featuring costumed participants performing, begging for ingredients, and chasing after live chickens to be cooked in a communal gumbo. Parades are also held in other Gulf Coast cities such as Mobile, Alabama, and Pensacola, Florida, and there are other world-renowned celebrations in Brazil and Europe. So today's the last day before Ash Wednesday, and a lot of celebrating goes on around the world. Oh, let's see. This is a story from Business. The headline reads, Warner Brothers reopens takeover talks with Paramount after receiving a waiver from Netflix. The story comes from New York. Warner Brothers will reopen takeover talks with Paramount Skydance after receiving a seven-day waiver to do so from its preferred bidder, Netflix. Warner Brothers said in a regulatory filing on Tuesday, that the waiver will allow it to discuss unresolved deficiencies in Paramount's previous offers. Warner Brothers Discovery now has until Monday to negotiate a possible transaction with Paramount Skydance. While we are confident that our transaction provides superior value and certainty, we recognize the ongoing distraction for WBD stockholders and the broader entertainment industry caused by Paramount's antics, Netflix said in a statement. Accordingly, we granted Warner Brothers a narrow seven-day waiver of certain obligations under our merger agreement to allow them to engage with Paramount to fully and finally resolve this matter. Warner Brothers said on Tuesday that its board still recommends unanimously that shareholders vote for the Netflix buyout. Warner's leadership consistently has backed the offer from Netflix. In December, Netflix agreed to buy Warner's studio and streaming business for $72 billion, now in an all-cash transaction that the companies have said will speed up the path to a shareholder vote by April. Including debt, the enterprise value of the deal is about $83 billion, or about $27.75 per share. Unlike Netflix, Paramount wants to acquire Warner's entire company, including networks like CNN and Discovery, and went straight to shareholders with all cash, $77.9 billion offer in December. Warner Brothers has a special meeting scheduled for Friday, March 20th. The company's stock rose more than 2% before the markets opened on Tuesday. Shares of Paramount Skydance climbed nearly 3%, while Netflix's stock rose slightly. So that's a little story from the world of business. Let's see what comes from that particular transaction. There's another significant death yesterday, this one from the world of entertainment. Robert Duvall died at the age of 95. The story headline reads, Al Pacino, Francis Ford Coppola, and others paid tribute to Robert Duvall. Remembrances poured in on Monday in honor of Robert Duvall, the Oscar-winning actor known for roles in Apocalypse Now, Lonesome Dove, Tender Mercies, and the intrepid consigliere of the first two Godfather movies. Duvall died Sunday at the age of 95 at his home in Virginia, according to an announcement from his publicist and a statement posted on his Facebook page by his wife, Luciana Duvall. What a blow to learn of the loss of Robert Duvall, said Francis Ford Coppola, such a great actor and such an essential part of the production company American Zoetrope from its beginning. The Rain People, The Conversation, The Godfather Part II, Apocalypse Now, THX 1138, Assassination Tango, The Director of Godfather, and other Duvall movies. That was Francis Ford Coppola's comment. Al Pacino said, It was an honor to have worked with Robert Duvall. He was a born actor, as they say. His connection with it, his understanding, and his phenomenal gift will always be remembered. I will miss him. said Duvall's Godfather co-star in a statement on the Associated Press. Viola Davis, I've always been in awe of your towering portrayals of men who were both quiet and dominating in their humanness. You are a giant, an icon. Apocalypse Now, The Godfather, To Kill a Mockingbird, Tender Mercies, The Apostle, Lonesome Dove, etc. Greatness never dies. It stays as a gift. Rest well, sir. Your name will be spoken. Robert De Niro said, wrote, God bless Bobby. I hope I can live till I'm 95. May he rest in peace, said the actor who co-starred with Duvall in The Godfather Part II and True Confessions. Adam Sandler said, funny as hell, strong as hell. One of the greatest actors we've ever had. Such a great man to talk to and laugh with. Loved him so much. We all did. So many movies to choose from that were legendary. Watch them when you can. Sending his wife Luciana and all his family and friends our condolences. So that's a few of the comments that were made after the death of Robert Duvall at age 95 years old on Monday. Let's see. We'll take a look at a story, international story. The headline reads, Iran temporarily closed the Strait of Hormuz as it held the latest round of indirect talks with the United States. The story comes from Geneva. Iran announced the temporary closure of the Strait of Hormuz on Tuesday for live-fire military drills in a rare show of force as its negotiators held another round of indirect talks with the United States in Geneva over its disputed nuclear program. It was the first time Iran has announced the closure of the key international waterway through which 20% of the world's oil passes since the U.S. began threatening Iran and rushing military assets to the region. It marks a further escalation in a weeks-long standoff that could ignite another war in the Middle East. As the talks began, Iran's state media announced that it had fired live missiles toward the strait and would close it for several hours for safety and maritime concerns. The semi-official Tasnim news agency, which is close to the paramilitary Revolutionary Guard, said missiles launched inside Iran and along its coast had struck their targets in the Strait of Hormuz. Iranian state TV later said the talks had wrapped up after almost 3 hours. Iranian state TV had reported earlier that the negotiations would be indirect and will focus only on Iran's nuclear program and not domestic policies, including its bloody crackdown on protests last month. U.S. President Donald Trump has repeatedly threatened to use force to compel Iran to agree to constrain its nuclear program. Iran has said it would respond with an attack of its own. Trump has also threatened Iran over the killing of protesters. The first round of talks on February 6 were held in Oman, a sultanate on the eastern edge of the Arabian Peninsula, and were indirect. The latest were held inside the residence of the Omani envoy to Geneva, with the two sides apparently meeting separately with the mediators. Trump's envoys, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, were traveling for the new round of talks. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, who is leading the talks for Iran, met with the head of the UN Nuclear Watchdog Agency on Monday in Geneva. I am in Geneva with real ideas to achieve a fair and equitable deal, Araghchi wrote on X. What is not on the table, submission before threats. A diplomat close to the UN Nuclear Watchdog confirmed that Director General Rafael Grossi was also in Geneva to provide technical advice to both parties when requested. The diplomat spoke on condition of anonymity because of the sensitivity of the talks. Speaking to reporters Monday night aboard Air Force One on his way to Washington, U.S. President Donald Trump said he planned to be involved in the talks, at least indirectly. I think they want to make a deal. I don't think they want the consequences of not making a deal, he said. The U.S. is also hosting talks between envoys from Russia and Ukraine in Geneva on Tuesday and Wednesday, days ahead of the fourth anniversary of the all-out Russian invasion of its neighbor. Iran said its military guard started a drill early Monday in the Strait of Hormuz, the Persian Gulf, and the Gulf of Oman, which are crucial international shipping routes. It was the second time in recent weeks that Iran has held a live fire drill in the Strait of Hormuz. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Al-Khamenei, stepped up his warnings to the U.S. over its buildup of military forces in the Middle East. Of course, a warship is a dangerous apparatus, but more dangerous than the warship is the weapon that can sink the warship into the depths of the sea, Khamenei said, according to Iranian state TV. He also warned the U.S. that forcing the result of talks in advance is a wrong and foolish job. So that's a little update on what is happening in the talks between the U.S. and Iran over their nuclear capabilities. The Olympics have been going on now for about a little over a week, I guess. The headline of this story is Olympic meltdown. Norway's Alti Lee McGrath loses gold medal in the slalom and then control of emotions. Atli Lee McGrath's gold medal hopes in the Olympic slalom slipped away. His ski poles were then thrown away, and that he simply stumbled away through the snow toward the woods. It was all part of an epic Olympic meltdown that turned Monday's races into high tragic theater. I thought that I would get some peace and quiet, which I didn't, the Norwegian ski racer said of his retreat from the course after losing out on a medal. Because photographers and police found me out in the woods, but I just needed some time for myself. McGrath, who was born in Vermont but grew up in Norway, entered the final run of the final men's race at the Milan Cortina Games with a big lead in his best event. But after straddling a gate, McGrath lost a medal and then control of his emotions in a race won by Loic Meilonard of Switzerland. The 25-year-old McGrath tossed each pole over to the safety netting, lining the Stelvino course. He then climbed the fencing on the other side of the course and made his way through the snow to the edge of the wilderness, where he laid on his back. McGrath later arrived in the finish area and walked away without talking, but more than 2 hours later, he met the media at a nearby Bormio hotel. I am normally a guy that's very good when it comes to perspective on things, said McGrath, whose father, Felix, competed for the U.S. ski team at the 1988 Calgary Olympics. And if I don't ski well in a race, I can at least tell myself that I'm healthy and my family's healthy and the people I love are here. So that's nice, but that's not been the case. I've lost someone I love so much, and that makes it really hard. McGrath has been racing with a heavy heart, with his grandfather dying the day of the opening ceremony. He wore an armband as a tribute. What he's gone through these last 10 or 12 days, it's really been tough, said teammate Tim Hogan, who finished fourth in Monday's race. He's been really sad. He started to do better, and today he's going through, we really need to pick him back up today. McGrath was close to a medal, too. Very close. His mistake happened right in front of a Swiss coach standing on the course, whose celebration for Mylar's now guaranteed gold medal caused the team to later apologize to the Norwegians. I gave myself the absolute best opportunity you could today, McGrath said. I skied so great, and I still couldn't get it done. So that's what really hurts. Hogan felt for him. It's just heartbreaking, he said. He's doing everything perfect. He did a very good first run, put himself in a position to win the Olympic gold. He does everything right, and then that happens in 15 seconds. In the end, it's another ski race. In the end, it's not going to make or break Atli's career, Christofferson said. He is a great skier. If he keeps going like he's going, he will have great success for the future. This is just our sport. So, interesting to see. I don't know if you had the chance to catch that on the Olympic highlights. I certainly haven't been seeing many of the events live as they're generally very early in the morning. So I've missed that, but there's a good recap at night. And I did see that poor guy. He had a very good first run, and by the second run, snow conditions were pretty bad. It was snowing, and it was just a horrible thing for the that guy to go through. Take a look at this story from Georgia in the world of politics. The headline reads, Derek Dooley didn't vote for years. Now he wants Georgia voters to send him to Washington. Story comes from Atlanta. Lots of candidates pitch themselves as political outsiders. Derek Dooley goes a step further. Not only is the former football coach running for the first time, he says he did not vote for nearly two decades. He did not vote when Republican Donald Trump was first elected president in 2016, nor did he vote in 2020 when Trump lost to Democrat Joe Biden. But Dooley does not worry about that as he seeks the Republican nomination to face Democratic Senator John Ossoff in Georgia. He insists Washington needs someone with a fresh outlook, someone who is not focused on their own political career or their political ambitions. Besides, lots of people do not vote, and Dooley told the Associated Press that he wants to inspire more people to do so. If you're not vigilant in exercising that right, things can go pretty sideways in our country. Dooley's opponents in the May 19th primary include two congressmen, Mike Collins and Buddy Carter. Although Dooley supports Trump, Collins and Carter are more closely identified with Trump's Make America Deal Again brand. With support from the Moore establishment, Governor Brian Kemp, Dooley will test whether his outsider narrative is compelling at a time when Trump's Trump's anti-establishment movement already dominates the nation's capital. The primary winner will be among the most important Republican candidates in this year's midterm elections, with a chance to help the party preserve its thin Senate majority by ousting Ossoff. Dooley is the son of legendary University of Georgia football coach Vince Dooley. Derek Dooley worked as a lawyer before he started coaching. He led the University of Tennessee, but was fired after a losing record. He then worked as an assistant coach for other colleges as well as professional teams. He stepped away from the sidelines after the 2023 season, and Dooley said coaching people from a range of backgrounds will help him connect with Georgia's diverse voting population. In my 30-plus years professional career, it's never been about me and anything I was doing. It's always about people. Dooley said he got interested in politics during Biden's presidency when he was upset about lax border enforcement, economic policies, and support for transgender athletes. He has criticized Ossoff over the same issues. Dooley said he resumed voting in 2022 when he backed Kemp for governor, and he voted for Trump in 2024. Republican strategist Brian Robinson said, "You can tell this wasn't a guy who spent his life in politics or around politics or consumed by politics." Kemp was close with Dooley's family growing up, and he endorsed Dooley for Senate, putting establishment heft behind the political novice. "I was looking for a political outsider, and it just happened to be a guy that I've known for, 50-plus years," Kemp said on stage with Dooley during an event with the Atlanta Young Republicans on Thursday. Kemp and Dooley drew cheers from many in the crowd. Several people at the event said they had not decided on their primary choice, but appreciated Dooley's outsider perspective. The relationship between Dooley and Kemp does not impress other people. "Completely siloing yourself with the old establishment governor is not a way to say you're an outsider," said Cortland Cook, the chair of the Glynn County Republicans in southeast Georgia. She said voters will remember that Kemp and Trump have not always gotten along, a key issue when the president enjoys deep support from the party's base. Dooley's ties with Kemp are a target for political opponents. Devin Cruz, a senior communications advisor for the Democratic Party of Georgia, described Dooley as someone with access to the governor's political machine. Harley Adsit, a spokesperson for Carter's campaign, called Dooley the ultimate insider. Canton voter Vanessa Artigas, 53 years old, likes Kemp and understands why some of her friends used to not vote, so she will likely support Dooley. "I think we need to get career politicians out and get the voice of the people in," Artigas said. Artigas, who attended a local event for the conservative organization Turning Point Action. University of West Georgia student Timothy Jackson, 19, is planning to vote for Collins because of his close ties to Trump, but is open to Carter. Both of them have been in Congress, and so they know what it takes, Jackson said. Dooley is going to be hard because he's never been in that position before. A Kemp-linked group funded an advertisement for Dooley last fall, blaming Collins and Carter for the government shutdown, lumping them in with OSUF. Carter, a pharmacist, has been a political fixture along Georgia's coast for nearly three decades. Collins is a trucking company co-owner and the son of a former congressman. Republicans are going to face an uphill battle, but Dooley doesn't bring the baggage that other candidates could possibly bring and can speak not only to voters on the right and Republicans, but the voters in the center who will make the decision, said longtime Republican consultant Jason Shepard. John Ossoff has a voting record that Dooley can run on and pick apart. Dooley does not. So that'll be an interesting election. It looks like the primary's coming up in May. So a complete political outsider, so outside that he really has not voted much over the past few years. And it will be interesting to see what happens in that primary in May. We'll take a look at the possibility of peace in the war between the Ukraine and Russia. The headline of this story reads, Russia and Ukrainian officials meet in Geneva for U.S. brokered talks after almost 4 years of war. Story comes from Geneva. Delegations from Moscow and Kiev met in Geneva on Tuesday for another round of U.S. brokered peace talks a week before the fourth anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of its neighbor. However, expectations for any breakthroughs in the scheduled 2 days of talks in Switzerland were low, with neither side apparently ready to budge from its positions on key territorial issues and future security guarantees, despite the United States setting a June deadline for a settlement. The head of the Ukrainian delegation, Rustam Umerov, posted photos on social media of the three delegations at a horseshoe-shaped table, with the Ukrainian and Russian officials sitting across from each other. U.S. President Donald Trump's envoy Steve Witkoff and son-in-law Jared Kushner sat at the head of the table in front of U.S., Russian, Ukrainian, and Swiss flags. The agenda includes security and humanitarian issues, Umerov said, adding that Ukrainians will work without excessive expectations. Discussions on the future of Russian-occupied Ukrainian territory are expected to be particularly tough, according to a person familiar with the talks who spoke to the AP on condition of anonymity. Russia is still insisting that Ukraine cede control of its eastern Donbas region. Also in Geneva will be American, Russian, and Ukrainian military chiefs who will discuss how ceasefire monitoring might work after any peace deal and what is needed to implement it, the person said. During previous talks in Abu Dhabi, the capital of the United Arab Emirates, military leaders looked at how a demilitarized zone could be arranged and how everyone's militaries could talk to one another, the person added. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov cautioned against expecting developments on the first day of talks, as they were set to continue on Wednesday. Moscow has provided few details of previous talks. Ukraine's shorthanded army is locked in a war of attrition with Russia's bigger forces along the roughly 750-mile front line. Ukrainian civilians are enduring Russian aerial barrages that repeatedly knock out power and destroy homes. The future of the almost 20% of the Ukrainian land that Russia occupies or still covets is a central question in the talks, as are Kiev's demands for post-war security guarantees with a U.S. backstop to deter Moscow from invading again. Trump described the Geneva meeting as big talks. Ukraine better come to the table fast, he told reporters late Monday as he flew back to Washington from his home in Florida. It wasn't immediately clear what Trump was referring to in his comment about Ukraine, which has committed to and taken part in negotiations in the hope of ending Russia's devastating onslaught. The Russian delegation is headed by Russian President Vladimir Putin's advisor, Vladimir Medinsky, who headed Moscow's team of negotiators in the first direct peace talks with Ukraine in Istanbul in March of 2022, and has forcefully pushed Putin's war goals. Medinsky has written several history books that claim to expose Western plots against Russia and berate Ukraine. The commander of the U.S. military and NATO forces in Europe, General Alexis Grinevich, and Secretary of the U.S. Army Dan Driscoll will attend the meeting in Geneva on behalf of the U.S. military and meet with their Russian and Ukrainian counterparts, said Colonel Martin O'Donnell, a spokesman for the U.S. commander. Overnight, Russia used almost 400 long-range drones and 29 missiles of various types to strike 12 regions of the Ukraine, injuring 9 people, including children, according to the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky. Zelensky said tens of thousands of residents were left without heat and running water in the southern port city of Odessa. He said Moscow should be held accountable for the relentless attacks, which he said undermine the U.S. push for peace. The more this evil comes from Russia, the harder it will be for everyone to reach any agreements with them. Partners must understand this. First and foremost, this concerns the United States, the Ukrainian leader said on social media late on Monday. We agreed to all realistic proposals from the United States, starting with the proposal for an unconditional and long-term ceasefire, Zelensky noted. The talks in Geneva took place as U.S. officials also held indirect talks with Iran in the Swiss city. So that's a kind of an update on what is happening in the Ukraine. We'll see what let's see what other news is coming around the world. There's a story involving Mark Rubio. The headline reads, Rubio plugs Orban's bid for another term in Hungary's elections. Excuse me. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio on Monday enthusiastically endorsed Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban's bid to serve a fifth straight term after the April elections, emphasizing during a visit to Budapest the strong personal relationship between the nationalist leader and U.S. President Donald Trump. Orban, who has led Hungary since 2010, is one of Trump's most vocal supporters in the European Union. Excuse me. And has actively curried the U.S. president's favor leading up to the April 12th vote, in which he will face the toughest challenge of his last 16 years in power. Rubio was in the Hungarian capital for meetings with Orban and his government, where he signed an agreement on U.S.-Hungarian civilian nuclear cooperation that includes the possible purchase of compact nuclear reactors, known as small modular reactors, or SMRs, as well as U.S.-supplied nuclear fuel and spent fuel storage technology. At a news conference, Rubio said U.S.-Hungary relations, which both he and Orban described as experiencing a golden age under Trump, go beyond mere diplomatic cooperation. I'm going to be very blunt with you, Rubio said. The prime minister and the president have a very, very close personal relationship and working relationship, and I think it has been beneficial to our two countries. That person-to-person connection that you've established with the president has made all the difference in the world in building this relationship, Rubio continued, addressing Orban. President Trump is deeply committed to your success because your success is our success. Rubio's stop in Hungary followed a visit to Slovakia on Sunday after he previously attended the Munich Security Conference in Germany. Led by Eurosceptic populists who oppose support for Ukraine and vocally back Trump, Slovakia and Hungary are both friendly territory for Rubio in his push to shore up energy agreements with both Central European countries. Widely considered Russian President Vladimir Putin's most reliable advocate in the EU, Orban has maintained warm relations with the Kremlin despite its war against Ukraine, while building ties with Trump and his MAGA, short for the 2016 Trump campaign slogan, Make America Great Again movement. Orban has remained firmly committed to purchasing Russian energy, despite efforts by the EU to wean off such supplies, and received an exemption from U.S. sanctions on Russian energy after a November meeting in the White House with Trump. Rubio would not specify on Monday how long that exemption would last as the EU plans to phase out Russian fossil fuels entirely by the end of 2027. Apparently, trusting that his political and personal affinity with Trump could pay even greater dividends, Orbán and his government have sought to woo the U.S. leader to Hungary before the pivotal April elections, hoping such a high-profile visit and endorsement would push Orbán, who is trailing in most polls, over the finish line. On Monday, Orbán told Rubio that his government is ready to host any future trilateral peace summit among the United States, Russia, and Ukraine, and that Trump has an open invitation to Budapest. He also claimed that Ukraine and its president, Volodymyr Zelensky, were seeking to interfere in Hungary's elections by criticizing Orbán's opposition to providing weapons or financial aid to Kiev and threats to block Ukraine's eventual membership in the EU. Many in MAGA and the broader conservative world view Hungary as a shining example of successful conservative nationalism, despite the erosion of its democratic institutions and its status as one of the EU's poorest countries. Orbán has riffed on Trump's popular slogan and declared that he and his movement seek to make Europe great again. In turn, Trump has praised Orbán's firm opposition to immigration, exemplified by a fence his government erected on Hungary's southern border in 2015 as hundreds of thousands of refugees fled Syria and other countries in the Middle East and Africa. So that's a little story from Hungary, the prime minister running again for his fifth term, and it seems like he certainly has some strong opposition there. So we are really don't have much more time to go. I'm trying to take a look at some of the other headlines. North Korea opens a housing district for families of its soldiers killed in the Russian-Ukraine war. And we are just about out of it. So we have reached the end of our hour together. I want to thank you for listening to the articles I've selected to read to you. I hope you found them to be enjoyable and interesting. I look forward to reading the news with you again in the near future. Until we have a chance to do that, I hope that life gives you many reasons to smile. Be well, my friends.